very apropos to talk about this question, Judaism and Western culture, as we know, the world is celebrating their holidays this week. We study this beginning of the story, or half the story, of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the argument that he has with his fellow colleagues, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi. And this argument eventually led to the exiling or the running away of Rabbi Shimon, first to the Beit Midrash with his son, and then after it became too dangerous to be in the Beit Midrash, ran away to the cave. While he was in the cave, as we know, they're studying there very intensely, very intense Torah sessions, perhaps the secrets of the Torah, perhaps the Zohar, as we mentioned. We'll see a little bit more on that, talk a little bit more about that today. And time passes on, 12 years pass on, and the time comes to leave the cave because the Caesar has died and the people that want to kill Rabbi Shimon are no longer there and the threat is gone. And Eliyahu HaNavi comes and he stands at the entrance to the cave and he says, who's going to tell Bar Yochai, who's going to tell Rabbi Shimon that he is safe, coast is clear, you can leave the cave. Rabbi Shimon and his son go out, and the first thing that they see is people are plowing and planting, remember? They're working the fields, and they get very upset, and they start to burn everything in sight and destroy everything that they see, and God calls out, Bakol comes out and says, hey guys, what are you doing? I didn't tell you, you can come out of the cave, so you can just destroy everything. Go back in the cave. Rabbi Shimon and his son go back in the cave, and they spend 12 months back in the cave. They come back out. What happens after this? They go back out, and it's Erev Shabbat, and they see a zaken, a saba, an older person, running before Shabbat with two hadasim in his hands. Where are you going? What are you doing? Kavod Shabbat, he says, one piece before that. The second time when they come out, before they see the old man running, the son, Rabbi Shimon's son, is still destroying things, and Rabbi Shimon is fixing everything that he destroyed. Then they see this old man, Zachor v'Shamor, one for Zachor, one for Shamor, it's the Kavod Shabbat. And from that moment, Rabbi Shimon is very put at ease. Now, there is an end to the story, which we're going to try to get to today. Not today, we'll finish it next week. But I want to go step by step here and try to understand what is actually going on in the story. What is actually taking place? So let's, and we had the questions that were on the back page that we left off with. Let's first start with, on the first page, this opening to the story, which describes the Rabotenu that went, we're studying in Kerem B'Yavne. So we mentioned last time that Yavne was the location of the Sanhedrin after the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed and the Jews were basically kicked out of Jerusalem. They were given the ability to rebuild or to relocate. I don't know about rebuilding, but at least, at the very least, they were given the ability to relocate their central power, central authority to Yavne. Now, the reason why it was called Kerem B'Yavne was, of course, because there were vineyards there, but there was another reason why it was called Kerem B'Yavne. The Kerem, the idea of a Kerem, when you go to a vineyard, the first thing you see is rows of vines, right? That is the kind of the symbol of a vineyard. The vineyard is set up in rows, and these rows have, you know, these vines of grapes running through them. So there's a symbol here. This is what I want to start with. The symbol of rows versus, okay, what the Sanhedrin was set up in Yavne in rows. What we mean by that is the rabbis of the Sanhedrin didn't sit in one semicircle, which is what it looked like in the Beit HaMikdash, in the Lishkar HaGazit, where the Sanhedrin was on Har HaBayit. So everybody sat in one row, kind of everybody could see each other, wherever you were sitting, you could see each other, it was sort of a semicircle, not a full half circle, but an almost full half circle, and that's how everybody sat. The elder sages sat closer to the middle, and the newer, younger scholars would sit on the ends.
So it's like a semicircle, wasn't really rows, but it was a semicircle where they could see everything.
It was
a half semicircle, you're saying? But yeah. They weren't actually rows, it was just so they
had. No, so it was one line in the Sanhedrin in the Beit HaMikdash, and near the Beit HaMikdash. And what would happen was, as people would get older and retire, everybody on the ends would move in, right? You would move over your seat, as people would either pass away or retire from their positions. And then in front of the Sanhedrin were these kind of benches where the students would sit. And if you were in the front row, you were kind of like on deck. Baseball reference, for those who know what I'm referencing. And as the seats would clear out, okay, the people in the front rows would take over their chairs. Good? So that's what went on in the Sanhedrin. One row, one kind of seating arrangement that was a semicircle. And when the Sanhedrin moved to Yavne, they sat in rows, a few rows. I think three rows was the number. So that same number of rabbis, same number of judges, same number of people in the Sanhedrin, but sitting in a very different arrangement. What is the symbol of one row versus multiple rows? What is that? What do you think when you hear that sort of concept? Any ideas? There's something significant here, and the hint is, think about when there was a Beit HaMikdash, now there is no Beit HaMikdash. Why would the setup of the Sanhedrin be different? Why would they change the arrangement of the seating? Any thoughts? The idea of a kerem, the idea of a vineyard with rows versus a semicircle line. Yeah.
Maybe it has to do with like when you have rows versus like when you have like just one row, it kind of it creates a sense of not like unity, but like, you know what I mean? Whereas instead of people are like so could be so far away from each other, if you're all in one line, there's a sense of like they all work, you know what I mean? People move out, people move in, but they all are in one line, so they're all in constant communication.
Versus
when you're in so many different rows. I mean, if you're in one row and then the person's 10 rows away from you, there's very little communication and you don't really work together as much.
Beautiful. Any other additions or a different way to think about that? That was great. That was great. That's more or less how many of the commentaries understand this idea. The difference between the Sanhedrin that existed at the time when there was a Beit HaMikdash, and this is critical, because it doesn't just reflect on the nature of the community of leadership. Community of leadership, as Vanessa is saying, was unified, was united. But it wasn't just united in the sense that they would sit in a certain way. It symbolizes what the Beit HaMikdash symbolized. The Beit HaMikdash, the temple, the center of the Jewish world, of the universe, in a sense, in Yerushalayim, on the Har Habayit, in that place, was, in a sense, the unifier of all of Am Yisrael, of all the different parts of the Jewish people. And the Sanhedrin, the way the Sanhedrin was set up, was reflecting the fact that the Jewish people were living in a certain harmonious time of history. That all the authorities, even if they had different voices and different opinions, all lined up in one line of seating. And that seating arrangement reflected a certain unifying force, a unifying vision, a unifying voice of all the varying opinions. All the details or all the small particular individuals were unified into one. And in some ways, that's the ideal. That's the ideal, that Yerushalayim should have one Beit HaMikdash. Once upon a time, there were no shuls. Right? It was just one central Beit Knesset, Beit HaMikdash. Things change over time, and if we have a Beit HaMikdash again, I don't think all the shuls will close down and close down for business, but we will once again have that sort of unifying force, that place where all, and we do to an extent have ways to remember this, right? We all pray in the same direction, no matter where we are in the world. Certain things that we do we do in relation to the unifying force of the Beit HaMikdash, even though right now it's just a location and not a building and not a place that we can go and be together with all of Am Yisrael there. But what happened was we went into a time of Sha'at HaDchak. We went into a time of despair, of deep division, disunity, the opposite of unity, the opposite of Achdut, and a distancing of Hashem from the center of the Jewish people. The Shekhinah was lacking, was missing in a certain way, certain intensity was lacking. So what happens at that moment in history when we don't have a Beit HaMikdash anymore? There's a schism, we split apart. And the rows of Kerem B'Yavneh, the rows of the Sanhedrin, represent and symbolize that these diverse opinions, which once were unified, are now being kind of spread out among the nation. And the symbol of that, I think, is quite powerful, because it also means that that time in history needed that sort of leadership, needed different types of voices. So now let's turn to the story itself, because that's the background. What happens in the story? You have three opinions, essentially. What are we supposed to do now? We're not in charge anymore. The Romans are in charge. They're bringing in all these different innovations and structures into society. And we're not sure how the Jewish community is supposed to relate to these outside influences, these external impacts that are here in our community, here in our country. So let's deal with the question of these three opinions and who comes out as the winner. So let's remind ourselves. Rabbi Yehuda was the one who said, sort of praising, use that term loosely, he's not actually, doesn't think the Romans are wonderful, but he thinks that there's some value to what they've contributed to society, and we as a people shouldn't just, reject it. We shouldn't just push it away. We should think of ways to integrate it in a healthy way, in an appropriate way. That was Rabbi Yehuda's opinion. Rabbi Yossi was quiet. He was silent. Shatak. We'll come back to that silence, which we started to analyze a bit last time. And then there's Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who said, don't believe them, don't be fooled. Everything that they're doing is false. It's just a mirage. It's just there to trick you. They want to get you into their society and then influence you, and they want you to assimilate. They just want the Jews to kind of vanish. But they're going to do it in their way and trick. Don't think, don't be fooled by the external showing. Ah, they built a beautiful bridge. Don't get fooled by the beautiful bridge. The bridge is just there. Its root, its intention, its motivation is all corruption and trying to influence very negatively. So who would you say, poll the audience, who would you say comes out as the winner? We know what happens in the story. Who do you think should be, who do you think is right? I don't know, maybe the winner's not the right word, but who carries the day? Think of Jewish history today, and think of then. What do you think? Whose opinion makes the most sense to you?
I'll check. The one who not only praises but kind of agrees with the Romans sometimes.
Okay. So Rabbi Yehuda,
yeah.
In moderation.
Yeah.
Let's see what this is about. Let's figure out a kosher way to. We do that all the time, right? I'm going to, go to university, or I'm going to go to work, but I'm going to make sure that I'm a religious person, I keep kosher, I keep Shabbat, so I'm going to tell them before, I have to leave early on Friday, when we go to business meetings, we tell them before, we let them know, these are my standards. We're going to join the world, we're going to go to school, we're going to go to university, but we're going to, make sure that we, are setting time out of the week to daven, to learn, join the Hillel, join the whatever it is, and we figure out a way to, right, balance. So that's essentially what you're trying to say, correct? Rabbi Yehuda is the approach that has proven to be what Jewish history has kind of unfolded to look like. The Jews are part of the world. For many generations, we actually did isolate ourselves in ghettos. When I say ghettos, I mean enclaves, places where Jews sort of lived among themselves, worked among themselves, governed themselves, etc. That was before there were countries and states. And so, Rabbi Yehuda seems to have a very strong approach. Now, does anybody want to argue Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai? Take their opinion and champion it before we kind of go into who each of these people are, what they represented. Anybody? No, everybody's good. Nobody wants to take on the underdog or the extreme positions. People like, I would say, show of hands, most people here agree with Rabbi Yehuda's approach. Most people here, kind of some nods, yeah? Okay. The truth is, though, and this is why it's important to study this, three opinions are taught. Rabbi Yehuda's opinion isn't the only one that's shared. What does that say to us if we're being shown or being exposed to three different approaches? What might that be coming to say?
We're not unifying.
Okay, yes, it does represent what we said before about, you know, this post-Churban Beit HaMikdash reality. Go ahead.
I don't think this is what you're looking for, but it's like my spin on it. It's like, for different people, different things work.
Okay, that's actually exactly what I think this is saying. Yeah. Let me just take it one step further to say, you're right. Each person's going to connect to the opinion that maybe fits best for them. And if we're being presented with three, it means there are three sort of legitimate types of approaches out there. So on the one hand, like you're saying, there is value to each opinion. But I would take it even a step further, and there has to be a way, there should be a way, to say all of them are right, all of them are correct, as you're saying. But not only are all of them correct, but maybe there's even a way to combine them somehow, even if they seem to contradict or go against each other. We have to explore that a bit further. But that's exactly the direction I think we want to go in. And the reason is as follows. And I'll share with you the following story. A few weeks ago, I was in New York. And we went to the United Nations. Not the friendliest place for the State of Israel. But Israel, of course, is a recognized state in the United Nations. And they have a whole team there on the ground trying to work on behalf of supporting and advancing Israel's interests at the United Nations. One of the things that we heard there, one of the things that we were exposed to there, was this question or challenge of challenging your own narrative. So I would probably guess that most of us went to schools or grew up in communities that promoted a strong pro-Israel agenda. Speakers that came to your community, to your shul, to your school, maybe even your experience here in Israel, probably going to take a guess that you're not hearing too much of the narrative that's on the other side of the fence.
Jewish high school, and senior year, we had like a huge blow up.
Okay, go ahead.
There was like the person in charge of the school newspaper, like the student run one, is not pro-Israel.
Okay.
And so she published like two articles.
Something anti-Israel.
Yeah, anti-Israel. And
Palestinian narrative.
Yeah.
But was it truths or was it just propaganda? That's my...
It was true. One of them, it was two articles. One was like a personal take.
Okay.
And so...
She Palestinian?
She's like Arab, yeah.
Okay.
And the other was like, this is what's on the news. And it was just like one of those websites that are like...
Okay.
Israel.
Okay.
And then we tried, like me and two of my friends wrote a whole other article to publish it, and it didn't get passed.
Didn't get passed.
And then we like worked all a second
BDS.
To pass it, and they finally published it the night before graduation.
Wow.
But like that's so stupid.
Yeah, who's gonna read it?
Paper.
Right. Correct. Now it's very interesting that you share that. It's very interesting that you share that. What I'm about to say is not, you know, I don't think this is. I don't necessarily consider myself. to have enough information to speak on behalf of a different narrative. I know my narrative. I know the narrative that I think I've probably learned over the years. But when you see certain things and you look at pictures and you read, and you talk to people, there is such a thing as the other narrative. There's such a thing as opinions that are on a different, that are different than your own. Whether you agree with them or not, if they're coming from a true place, they're coming from a sincere place, what that does for us is it doesn't, hopefully, doesn't actually confuse us. But what does it do? And this is sort of on the line of what Shoshu's sharing. That those opinions, those different narratives can strengthen our own. Because when we hear something, and you may recall, we spoke a little bit, we did an Agadah earlier this year. Remember the story of Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish? He jumps in, and then Rabbi Yochanan gets very sad after Reish Lakish dies, because Reish Lakish was a person who was always challenging him. He was like the other narrative. He was a bandit. He came from a world that was very opposite in every which way to where Rabbi Yochanan lived. But because he was opposite, he was a disruptor, okay, to use the modern term, he would come in and he would disrupt sort of the status quo, and he would ask questions that were sharp and interesting and different and a perspective that nobody had really heard before. And all of a sudden, Rabbi Yochanan is very challenged to defend his position. So it's not just about defense, it's about broadening. When you hear a different narrative than your own, as long as, I believe this to be true as well, you have to be very educated in your own narrative. And unfortunately, a lot of Jewish people are not educated in their own narrative, and that's why some people get persuaded or influenced to believe something else. But if you educate yourself about Israel, about history, about Tanakh, about Torah, about Halakha, the more you educate yourself, and that's in a way what I'm trying to do here, spending the time focusing on these topics, then when you hear the other narrative, A, you'll either just say it's false, it's based on nothing, because you are educated and you know the history. Or if it's true, you'll stop and you'll say, you know what? I'm not necessarily going to agree with that person, but I'm willing to broaden my narrative and say, there actually is a different story. There actually is another side to the story, and I can be more sensitive toward that. And I can be more tolerant of that. And that's also valuable, and that's also important. So these three opinions, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Yossi, are all within one frame, but each opinion helps us broaden our narrative. And I think that's really critical for our day and age. There are different ways to practice Judaism, as we know. Not just within Orthodoxy, to the left and to the right. And we stop for a second and say, am I tolerant of the person who doesn't practice Judaism the same way that I do? Or am I intolerant? It's very easy for us to be tolerant. Generally, in the Orthodox, modern Orthodox community, we're tolerant very much, usually, of people who are more liberal, less religious. But sometimes people who are more religious, we aren't as tolerant. I'm not saying this about anybody in this room, but it does happen in communities that I've visited and spent time in. And that's important if we're putting, Rabbi Yehuda, let's say, in the middle. I'm not saying Rabbi Yehuda was modern Orthodox. But let's say we're putting him in the middle. Where is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai? He's at an extreme. Or if he's on the left, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is on the other side, right? But what we're going to see as we sort of go into this a little bit more, they're not necessarily actually disagreeing. They might be coming at this from different angles, but they're not necessarily disagreeing. Hard to see that right now, but let's explore that a bit further. Okay. So we want to incorporate and consider. Let me give you two mishalim, two analogies to this, just to sharpen the point. Okay, the first one is, I don't know if you've ever seen the optical illusion where you have like rows of sticks, okay? Or I'll give you, you go to a forest, right? And you see trees that were just planted in a row. So if you look at the trees from, let's say, the side, okay? They look like they're in a straight line. You're just looking straight and you see the trees in a straight line. If you go to a corner, from a different vantage point, It might look like they're on an angle. It's an optical illusion. Obviously, they're in a line because that's how they were planted. But sometimes when you look at things from different angles, they give you a fuller picture of what you're actually looking at. Or today, they have 3D imaging that they do in medical practices all the time. Somebody has a broken bone, something of that nature. So the x-ray is not just going to be taken from the front. The x-ray is going to be taken from the side, that side, the back, the top, the bottom. And what happens when you have different angles of the picture? You get a more comprehensive view of what you're looking at. So we're looking at Judaism, Jewish life, Jewish living. How is a Jew meant to live their life in this world? So it's not enough to just look at Rabbi Yehuda's position. We have to look at it from Rabbi Shimon, from Rabbi Yossi, from all these various angles. And the more angles we incorporate, the greater and stronger our understanding of what it is to be a Jew will be developed. Clear? Good? Okay. And it's important to point this out. The rabbis weren't arguing about the righteousness or the evil of the Romans. Everybody agreed. Even Rabbi Yehuda wasn't praising, you know, the Romans. You're not allowed to praise the non-Jews anyway. You're not allowed to. It's an interesting halachic question, which is very kind of timely for the year. Giving people who run businesses, are they allowed to give gifts, holiday gifts or bonuses? You know, that's very common in the secular offices. So this is an interesting question. Because if you're giving a bonus at the end of the year, you're sort of participating, celebrating in some connecting way a non-Jewish holiday, which may have its roots in Avodah Zarah, perhaps. This isn't a class on halakha, but it's an interesting halakha question. Now, one of the responses, just so that I don't leave you hanging, one of the approaches to this is that you're not actually giving the bonus, let's say, if it's food, you have to make sure it's kosher. That's a whole other discussion. But if you, let's say it's money, right? Somebody worked a whole year, you want to show appreciation, you're giving them a bonus. It's always done at the end of the year. This is when it's done. So you give a bonus. You're not giving a bonus to say happy holidays to the person. You're giving a bonus to say you did a great job. You have to make sure that the intention and the reason why you're doing it is not to praise their holiday, is not to celebrate their holiday. So, you know, some people will do their holiday party, not right before, they'll do it a month before. And it's just sort of an end of the year type of thing. And again, so these are things that will come up. They will come up in your professional life, unless you, you know, choose to work in the Jewish community or live in Israel, which is also good. But whatever you choose to do, whatever, you know, lies in your future, these are questions that are going to come up and things you have to consider. And that's why this is so important to look at and to talk about. So even Rabbi Yehuda wasn't praising, right? You're not allowed to praise. And Chas v'Shalom to say that, you know, that Rabbi Yehuda would do such a thing. But now this is critical. Imagine if we didn't have a Rabbi Yehuda. Imagine if Rabbi Yehuda had taken on Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's position and we didn't have a voice that was guiding the future of the Jewish people, future of Jewish history. Or had Rabbi Yehuda not been around and we only had Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's opinion. Right? So we do need all of them. We do need all of them. So let's go into the second part of the story. Let's talk a little bit about Rabbi Yehuda. We mentioned, okay, Rabbi Yehuda was the sort of the Amuda Shel Torah Masit. He's looking at what practically do the Jewish people need to survive. He has to make a choice. He says, if I don't make a decision, I'm the leader of the Jewish people. If I don't make a decision that's going to give the Jews instructions for living, what's going to happen? Because right now, they're broken. They're down. They're finished. Temple's destroyed. The Beit HaMikdash is gone. He's very sensitive to this, you know, spiritual vulnerability of the people. There's no more Avodah. Avodah meaning there's no more daily worship in the Beit HaMikdash. We don't have that going on anymore. There's only There's only the Torah. That's all we have left. And who's kind of running everything in the world? Who's running the economy? Who's running the markets? Who's running the states? Who has all the power? Who's inventing all the science and taking care of all the health in society? It's the Romans. The Roman Empire is in charge.
This
is all coming from Rabbi Yehuda. This is what's behind his perspective. We're just trying to analyze a little bit, understand.
So he's praising them.
It's not praising them. It's working together. It's working within the current reality, which is not an ideal reality. He says, he makes comments, right? What is his line? He says, "How pleasant are the actions of this nation," right? Which comes off as praising, but it's not saying the Romans are righteous. Because he agrees with Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. They're corrupt people. The means in which they try to do things is not correct. But if I don't educate the Jewish community, right now, in this time, everything that they do in society is being run by an external group. We're not in charge of the economy. We're not in charge of the state. We're not in charge of the power. We're not in charge of health. We're not in charge of science. We're not in charge. Period. We don't have power. So if we don't have power, and this is the critical point, we have to decide right now how to educate the next generation. If we don't give them a message that there is a way to be part of society in a healthy way, in an appropriate way, we're going to lose. We're going to lose in history. And maybe that will be the end of the Jewish people. We don't want them to look at the world negatively. We want them to look at the world that there's a way to participate. There's a way to be part of this. Especially in the realm of Tikkun Olam, right? And Binyan HaChaim, building the world, building our lives. When we say Tikkun Olam, we don't mean, you know, Tikkun Olam like the organizations today. Tikkun Olam means literally building the world. Building cities, building society, building economy, building states. So it's an educational standpoint. He's praising the Tikkunim. He is praising them. But he's not praising them because it's the Romans. He's praising them because it's good to build the world, but we have to build the world in the right way. And if we just say, oh, we're going to go into a cave, and it was such a critical point in history, what's going to happen? That's what the generation's going to hear. They're going to hear, this is what our leadership says. We should just disengage from society. And what's going to be the result? They're going to think everything is bad. They're going to think everything is negative. There can never be anything good that can come from actually trying to build the world. We have to figure out how to balance these points. Guf and neshama, right? The body and the soul. Olam hazeh and olam haba. As Jews, we're always in tension. How to put those two things together. How to combine them. I mean, our being is a combination of the two. And it's a constant battle. So that's Rabbi Yehuda. What about Rabbi Yossi? What about Rabbi Yossi? Rabbi Yossi is silent. So how did we understand Rabbi Yossi last time? Does anybody remember some of the things that we said? Have you ever written down what we said last time? Remember? Silence, sometimes, can be taken to be a sign of weakness. It could be viewed as a sign of weakness. You're not strong enough to speak up. You're just standing there. You're just waiting there. But here, it's not what this is. This is not a sign of weakness here. It's not the inability to speak or have an opinion. Rather, in some ways, it's l'chadchila. What do we mean by l'chadchila? It's ideal in a way that he was silent. Specifically here, not in all circumstances. Why? Because what's he saying by not saying anything? What is he communicating? Rabbi Yehuda has value and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai has value. They each have value. In a way, I know you said before you liked Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yossi, in a way, is a little bit more of a reality for us. Because there's value in the different opinions. And he's struggling to choose, so he just doesn't choose. And by not choosing, he's communicating that both are important, that both are valuable, that both are critical. So in some ways, like I said, Rabbi Yossi represents the majority of Am Yisrael. Why? Who's Rabbi Yehuda? Rabbi Yehuda is a posek, he's a leader, he's... Every Jew is going to be like Rabbi Yehuda. No. We're more like Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi was obviously a great person, a great sage, a great scholar. But he represents in some ways, the middle path. He's not in command of the secrets of the Torah like Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. He's not in command of the entire community like Rabbi Yehuda. He's simply telling us, study the text, know what you need to do as a Jew, study the Agadah, know what you need to feel as a Jew. Right? The difference between halakha and Agadah, as we've spoken about a few times. And that's the idea of silence. What about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai? What about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai? He's the master of Torah secrets. Mare Derazim, the master of Torah secrets. And he doesn't fall for any of the tricks. He sees the Romans as a pig. Did we say this last time? Did we speak about this? I don't remember if we did or we didn't. Let's explain it. We know in the Torah we have the laws, the Simanei Kashrut. What are the Simanei Kashrut for a kosher animal? Two Simanim, split hooves, and chewing cud. So there are four animals that have one but not the other. Three of them have one and not the other, and the other one has the other and not one. Which is that one? So three out of the four have chewing cud but not split hooves. And the pig, the chazir, has split hooves but not chewing cud. Now what's actually practically the difference on an animal's body between hooves and chewing cud? Where are these things taking place?
Mouth and the feet.
Pardon? So put those into like categories.
External
versus internal, right? The hooves are outside, you can see them. Chewing cud is a digestive process. It's not something you see. I mean, you can see the animal chewing, but you don't see the actual process taking place. It's an internal experience, internal process. Therefore, the pig is very interesting. Because on the outside, the pig actually looks like a kosher animal. But on the inside, it's not kosher. It doesn't have the second symbol of kashrut. So this is very interesting. We'll conclude with one more point after this. What is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai saying? Who are the Romans? The Romans are compared to the chazir. There are four animals that have one, not the other. These, in the Midrashim, these represent the four sort of galiot, or empires, that ruled in the world, that took over the Jewish people at one point or another. Right? With the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans, the final galut. The thought was still sort of in that phase of history. And the Romans represent, explains Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the Romans represent the chazir. Because on the outside, and this was his whole point, what does the pig do? This is actually described in Midrash. The pig, you know, lies down on his back, puts out his feet, and says, "Hey, look, I'm kosher. Look, I split hooves." Right? Gives off this impression that indeed the symbols of kashrut are there. But when you look on the inside, those symbols are not there. It's missing that element of kashrut. And what are the Romans, according to Shimon Bar Yochai? Externally, they build bridges, they make markets. Right? Think about our world today. The world that tries to, in some ways, pull us in. Whatever it is, okay, whatever whatever you're thinking about, something in the world that's attractive, that's flashy, that's lights, and it's saying, "Hey, come and be part of the world." But really, when you get inside of it, or when you get behind the curtain, you see that there's not so much kosher going on over there. You see that there's not so much of a Jewish environment going on over there. But on the outside, it looks very nice, with nice brochures, with nice advertisements. Right? That's our world. Doesn't mean that there isn't a way to do it in the right way. But don't be fooled, says Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. And his approach is, we're just going to back away. Because it's if what is behind it is corrupt, and what is behind it is tameh, and what is behind it is inappropriate, then the whole thing is inappropriate. Now we know that Rav Shimon Bar Yochai was not the opinion that carried the day, and he actually ends up having a transformation in this story, which we'll not get to today, but we'll get to in the next time. But that's his approach. The last part of this is Yehuda ben Gerim. Who's Yehuda ben Gerim? Yehuda ben Gerim was the guy in the beginning of the story who reported this conversation between Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. What is Yehuda ben Gerim's role? It sounds like he's a tattletale. That's what it sounds like when you read the story. The language in the story was, Halach Yehuda ben Gerim v'siper divrehem v'nishma'u l'malchut. So Rashi writes on the Gemara that he didn't actually go to the Roman authorities. He spoke to his family, he spoke to his friends. And then, you know, secret secrets, they get out. He didn't necessarily intend for this conversation to get to the Roman authorities, but what did it cause? It caused huge problems for Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai to run away to the cave. So what do we call that in Jewish speak, Jewish law? It's not mazid, it's not a purpose, it wasn't intentional. It's shogeg. It was unintentional. Unintentionally, this conversation, which was off the record, eventually made its way to the Roman authorities. But what was his intention? So this was a time in history, as we said, it was confusing, it was depressing. Jewish people did not know what was going to happen to them as a people. The future was very, very, very gray and bleak. So what was he was just worried. He's very worried, he's very concerned. What he heard, so he speaks to his family about it, he goes home, he says, I need to tell you what happened today. I need to tell you what I heard today in the Beit Midrash. But the problem is that it was still a mistake. Meaning, just because you don't do something intentionally, doing something unintentionally is still a mistake. Even if it's a mistake, it's a mistake. How do mistakes come about? How does this mistake come about? So here it gets to a very sort of sensitive, very sensitive topic. That's the truth of the matter. And that's the topic of Gerim, converts. Converts love Judaism in some ways more than the Jews, more than the people who are born into it. If anybody here has ever met a convert or knows a convert in their family or friends and heard their story, we know that they come to Judaism through a deep, deep, deep love and exposure that just overpowers everything that they are. But they're lacking something biologically or genetically. I use those words very carefully. Right? They're lacking something. They weren't born as a Jew. They weren't born into the people. So they're missing a certain, call it an intuition, a certain part of them that every other person who's born as a Jew has that they don't have and they'll never have.
Who's they?
They, people who convert into the Jewish people. So one of the explanations of this, and with this we'll conclude, is that, and the Gemara calls it, the Gemara says it's kasheh gerim kesapachat. A sapachat is like a growth in the skin. It's like one of the types of tzarat that the Torah describes. It's a very negative attribution. It's like converts are like tzarat. It's very negative. But what it means is not that they're bad people. The opposite. They're incredible, they're inspiring, they're amazing. But they lack, they're sort of external. They attach themselves onto the Jewish people like this, you know, growth on the skin. And we welcome them in with open arms. And we're not supposed to say anything bad. And we're not supposed to remind them of their past. We're supposed to love them with extra love. And the Torah goes out of its way, I think, 27 times in the book of Dvarim. Love the convert, love the convert, love the convert. We have to give them extra care and sensitivity because of where they come from. But they lack a certain sensitivity at the same time because they weren't born into the people. That sensitivity is the sort of the natural Jewish thing. You would never say, if you heard Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, a Jewish person would never say such a thing, would never speak it out, because they have that sensitivity. That's something very challenging to understand and wrap our heads around, but that's one of the explanations here. How could Yehuda ben Gerim get to such a mistake, which was very severe? Okay, we have a lot more to see and a lot more to continue in this. We have to talk about the cave, etc., and what happened after that. And for that, we will put on pause and finish up this whole story next week.